The From Day One podcast is brought to you by The Bridge and the Made in New York Media Center.
Hi, I'm Nick Bailey, and this is the From Day One podcast. Today we're sitting down with Gerard Mashey, the co-founder and visionary behind the Brooklyn-based eyewear brand Lowercase. His story begins in 2012, when a mysterious illness forced Mashey to leave his decade-long career in finance and fund management. After a miraculous recovery 2 years later, Mashey found himself back at square one and with a new zeal for life. The idea to launch an eyewear brand came easily. Mashey had been wearing glasses since he was 13 and had been collecting frames for years. In 2015, he teamed up with architect Brian Valerio, now his business partner, and hit the ground running. Despite recent inroads by other American brands, including Warby Parker, the global eyewear market and supply chain is still dominated by one company, the Italian mega brand Luxottica. Mashey and Valerio knew that in order to produce the small batch, high quality collections they envisioned, they needed to bring the manufacturing in-house. This was uncharted territory for Mashey, who had no prior experience in designer manufacturing. A few trips around his childhood neighborhood of Greenwich Village to source materials led Mashey to an acetate vendor who was supportive of the company's plans to manufacture locally. Today, Mashey and Lowercase team are part of the next era of American manufacturers, setting up shop in the recently renovated Brooklyn Army Terminal, a building in the Sunset Park neighborhood which has a rich manufacturing history of its own. They launched their first collection in January of this year. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I heard when Lowercase was just starting out, you taught yourself about eyewear manufacturing by watching YouTube videos. Is that true?
Yeah, it was a mix. It was a lot of Googling for small little pieces of opticians' information that they might post on their little chat boards that I hadn't, couldn't understand 99% of it. But as I Googled the terms, I would slowly understand the dialogue that was happening. And then I graduated essentially to watching YouTube videos, and you'll find clips, short clips of mostly Chinese manufacturing happening. And I was really just looking for like process flow and different types of equipment and what was needed. The process of making a pair of glasses can take over 2 weeks for one pair. And, when I first looked at a pair of glasses in the context of wanting to make it, it seemed a lot simpler than that. And the starting point was on my sofa for probably a year, honestly. It was a year of just doing research on trying to find material, trying to find processes before I traveled overseas to start meeting with potential suppliers.
Got it. Now, you had been, I guess, an enthusiast or a hobbyist of eyeglasses. Is that really true?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I my first pair of glasses was bought at a store here in the city that actually no longer exists. It was on the corner of Grand and Mercer, and it was called Facial Index. And Facial Index was an offshoot of the parent store in Japan. So this company had one store in Japan, and they happened to have one store in New York. And so all of their glasses were made in Japan. But the store in New York never knew what they were getting. They weren't told, or they weren't allowed to order. They would just receive a box from the parent company, open up the box, and it's like, that's your inventory. Like, go ahead and sell it. So every time I would go visit, it was kind of this new release of frames, and I was always compelled to buy at least one.
That's interesting. And you grew up in that neighborhood, right?
Yeah. I grew up by Washington Square Park, which is, 10 blocks away, super close.
So you're an old school New Yorker. What did your folks do?
My parents were in the restaurant business when I was growing up. Actually, they still are in the restaurant business. But my dad is from Italy and my mom is from Ireland. And they left their countries when they were really young, in their teens, in their young teens, and they'd always worked in the restaurant world in some capacity or another, usually as a waiter or a waitress. And in 1981, which happens to be the year I was born, they opened a restaurant in New York, and they had that restaurant for 30 plus years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then you yourself started on a different path, right? You went to you were working in finance before this job, business, right?
Yeah, exactly. When I went to college, my brother was the first person on either side of my parents' family to have gone to college, and so it wasn't really like I really looked to my brother for guidance on I didn't know what kind of jobs happened post college. I didn't know what kind of majors existed, and so he graduated and started working in finance. So as a younger brother, I graduated and started working in finance. And that, you know, that I know there's a lot of stories of people who leave finance and then, you know, say how awful of an experience was. That wasn't my experience.
Interesting.
I enjoyed working in finance. I wouldn't say it was my dream job. I didn't love it, but it was, you know, it was a job where, like, you know, there were really bad days and there were really good days, but most of the time it was just like pretty solid.
What side of the business were you on?
I worked right out of college. I worked at an investment bank. In sales. And I only lasted there for about 9 months, actually. I am not a salesperson. That's not my personality. So I left there and I went to work at a hedge fund. So mainly researching investments that I would propose to the fund owners. And so I really used a lot of those skill sets that I learned over the 13 years of doing it in trying to build my knowledge base out for the eyewear business. Like when I started.
So you had the kernel that maybe you would be doing your own thing at some point.
I guess, you know, I had never thought of it that way. But once I started feeling better, from my health problems, and I said, oh, maybe there's something in eyewear that I want to do. And I was thinking, like, maybe there's a job that is interesting for me out there, not that I want to start this company. And my past experience really helped me kind of break down the industry. Like you said, like, there's Luxottica out there, but there's also, you know, a lot of other little players, and like, who is manufacturing in the US, who is not manufacturing in the US, where is product coming from, who are the suppliers? Like, I was used to doing that for 13 years. I was in charge of technology, investments in technology companies. So a lot of, you know, people think of like Google and Facebook, but there's a lot of like hardware companies like Dell and Hewlett Packard, and like, they source lots of materials and they manufacture a lot of materials and they're not necessarily in the United States. And so just understanding how a supply chain of materials that are sourced from around the world and brought together and manufactured then sold in another geography, it was just easy for me to conceive how that might play out.
But the eyewear business is unique. This is, I think, a formerly pretty unknown fact that I think has entered the consciousness a little bit, that there's this one company that has this incredible hammer lock on the market. Walk me through it. Tell me how that works. What's the market like?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm not going to purport to know every number exactly, but these are general numbers as I understand them from the research I did, is that Luxottica owns roughly 80% of the worldwide market in eyewear.
And that's both prescription glasses and sunglasses and fashion stuff as
well. Yeah, so they own Sunglass Hut. So if you go into Sunglass Hut, you're buying a Luxottica pair of glasses. If you go into Lens Crafters, you're buying a Luxottica pair of glasses. So they've also bought brands like Ray-Ban and Oliver People, and they own Persol, which they purchased. So they kind of have the from beginning to end, from production to brand to distribution. But having said that, there are, you know, smaller kind of artisanal brands that, you know, that I was more interested in when I was buying for myself. But even those brands don't tend to produce for themselves. They'll outsource that production. So they're
more like design houses.
Exactly. In some ways. Exactly. They're not making product. You know, in my opinion, lowercase is almost before an eyewear company, we're a manufacturing company. Like, our passion and our efforts are on producing a really, really great product. Whereas other people, not that this is right or wrong, just a different approach, are really good at branding and marketing. And so they go to someone else for the product portion. And that's most companies, honestly.
Sure.
You know, they go to somebody else for the manufacturing portion. And I didn't realize that at first. I knew that about Luxottica, that, you know, they were the big behemoth. But I always thought these kind of smaller artisanal brands part of their kind of value was their control over their own supply chain. But I found that wasn't the case.
But to help me understand now, this 80% of the market, what does that mean for consumers? What does that mean for buyers? What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that it does is it, you know, props up pricing more than it would in a more open economic environment for eyewear, because not only do they own most of the big brands that people know about and care about, you know, if they're not like, you know, knee deep in eyewear, that, you know, they'll see like Chanel or whatever, and that, you know, and that's understandable. But they also own the distribution point. So they set the price for the industry, basically. And, you know, honestly, to tell you the truth, when I was looking at it in terms of what we wanted to do, I viewed the presence of Luxottica as a benefit to us. You know, it's not a benefit to the consumer, for sure. So I wouldn't say it's a good thing. But in terms of, if you want to start your own business that was kind of approaching something in a different way, being completely vertically integrated, which was very uncommon, is that here's a company that's setting quasi-monopolistic pricing. I wouldn't say, you know, full monopolistic pricing. And here we are, and we don't need to capture that level of profit. That's not what our goal is. So if we can make a good product, we can come in and price lower than comparable quality products, because they're not willing to give, because they don't care about some tiny company coming into the market. It's not going to make them adjust their price.
Sure. I mean, this is first year economics class stuff, right? Like, if you have a market, I mean, you know, first year economics teaches you that this can't possibly happen in a competitive marketplace, because someone will come in and competition will take over.
Right.
However, you know, as an entrepreneur, one can also think that, you know, first year economics sometimes doesn't help you. Sometimes there's a reason when you see an entire market that's dominated in some way, there might be a reason for that. So you're pointing out the opportunity, but it must have also been daunting, right, or scary to try to take on this marketplace. Clearly, there's stuff that you're not seeing that would make it hard for you, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in a simple way, the way I've explained it to people is, from the outside, the eyewear industry is a monopoly. Essentially, you can think of it that way, or a duopoly. You know, there's maybe three or four really like. A couple of junior versions of Luxottica, and between the three or four of them, like, that's the industry. And so I always thought of it as, it's really hard to break into that circle of the industry, but once you're inside of it, you have a lot of flexibility and freedom. Once you have some relationships with opticians or partners, or you get some consumer interest, you're at a point where you can disrupt the pricing of those competitors. And to me, you couldn't do that if you were sending your product overseas to be produced, because then the best you could do was have your cost and service levels in line with the other smaller competitors that are doing the same. Versus if we produce it in-house, one of the major benefits, in my opinion, was that by being vertically integrated, we can respond much faster to our customers' needs. So let's say that, you know, we had really great designs that we really loved, but we weren't going to do the production, and we were producing in Italy or China or wherever, irrelevant. We go place an order. Well, there's five other guys who have also placed an order, and you got to get in line behind those guys. And by the way, not only do you have to get in line behind those guys and wait for their batches to be done before your batch can start, you have to order at least X number of frames, a minimum order quantity. You know, it's usually in the mid hundreds, like 500 units. Well, what if I have a style an acetate, a piece of material that I think is a really, really great and really, really unique. But at the same time, I know there isn't a market for 500 people for this. Maybe there's a market for 70 people or 100 people, but it's a great differentiated product. What do you do if you don't, if you can't produce for yourself? You either make 500 and eat the 400 and sit on it, or you just say, we're going to have to pass on this one until we find something to go to market with that has a broader appeal.
Well, in some ways, you have a unique model, right? Because you're both making something that's almost like a medical device, really, in
totally.
Some cases, but it's also a piece of fashion.
Yeah.
And that's an unusual combination.
Yeah.
Of course, fashion brings with it certain constraints of speed and seasonality and stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas medical devices have a certain level of precision and regulation, and quality control.
Yeah.
How do you sort of balance that?
Yeah, it's really funny. We think about that a lot internally, because we don't provide prescription lenses with our glasses, like I know a lot of companies do. And the reason we don't do that is because we're not a medical company. And we think once you get into doing lenses, you are getting into the medical field. I mean, we don't think you are. You're getting into the medical field. And that's just not an arena that at least anyone currently in the company knows well. Really has an interest in learning. But at the same time, when we design our glasses, we have to make sure that they're appropriate for when lenses get installed, sunglass lenses get installed into the frames, that we have to make sure our designs can. So we work with opticians on those points. We just are not interested in creating the medical part of that. And our primary market, our primary distribution is through opticians, a lot of, I would say, half of our glasses is probably being used as a medical device. We are just not kind of implanting the medical portion of that device
yourself, right?
Exactly.
So we've established that this business is very complicated.
I'm confusing myself right now.
Right. So let's back up a little bit. You're working in investment banking. What happens next?
Yeah. So I was working in investment banking. I have always dealt with mental illness throughout my life, but it was manageable. I'd say it's like, you have your ups and downs. Everyone has their ups and downs. These were maybe a little bit more extreme than a quote unquote normal up and down. And then in 2012, I basically had a big episode that, I could talk for hours about.
Sure.
That kind of just knocked me out of the world. I just wasn't a present member of society. And so obviously I wasn't able to work. The company I was working for at the time was really great about it. They kept me on. They kept me on their insurance. They tried to stretch it out as long as possible. But, we were talking about going into years now. So long story short is I had the fortune to be able to see great doctors, which a lot of people don't have. And it took a long time for those doctors to figure out what was wrong. They hadn't come across this problem before. After, 2+ years, one of my doctors was like, I've seen this once before. I know what we have to do, and kind of proceeded with the treatment that literally, 5-7 days, I was like almost back to better than I was before. It was treating the kind of low-lying problem that had been there for years. It was even addressing that. And so here I was back in society, and I was, really like awake and energized. And so it's the kind of thing where if that wouldn't have happened to me, I would have stayed in finance. And I don't think I would have been upset about that. But having a forced break allowed me to kind of start fresh and evaluate from new eyes. And I was seriously considering going back to finance. That was kind of like, that was my heavy leaning, was like, I know this, I like this, like, I might not be the best at it, but I'm okay. Like, I know I can have a steady job at doing this. But actually one of my doctors was really instrumental in this, and she just was adamant that don't go back. You can't go back right away. Like, hey, eventually, if that's what you're going to do, that's what you're going to do. But, like, you know, you have to explore other options before you make that decision. And so, you know, considering I was out of work for over 2 years, you know, just to take another 3 or 4 months when I'm actually healthy to explore this wasn't really that big of a deal. It wasn't that heavy to say, like, oh, well, I'm not going to be working for 3 or 4 months.
Sure.
And I was literally sitting at home on my sofa, 100% on my sofa, just not even thinking about, like, jobs, whatever. And I went to change my glasses, because I changed my glasses a lot, just for my own love of them. And I was like, oh, I really love this stuff. Like, I have a real collection, and, like, I get super, it's like, I don't collect anything. I don't, like, have huge aggressive hobbies that I'm kind of constantly pursuing, but pursuing new glasses was something I kind of always did. And I never really thought about it that way. I just, like, passively built this collection. And it's not just glasses. It's the specific material, the acetate, as opposed to metal. Acetate is a plastic, but the base of it is not oil. The base of it's wood pulp. I wouldn't say it's a natural material, but it's a more natural material.
It's kind of a classic, right? It's one of, like, the earlier plastic.
Exactly. Kinds, right? Yeah. Exactly.
What was it used for? Was it used for old 78s, right? And, like, old records.
Exactly. And yeah. If you go to Jack White has a recording studio in Nashville. And he has he records straight to acetate, which is, like, those machines don't exist anymore. It's actually the only one I've ever seen. I'm sure there are other ones out there, but it's very, very rare. And you're right, that is kind of, like, one of the first uses for it. It can be used for combs, it can be used for whatever, because it has anti-static properties. That's why if you comb your hair, your hair isn't sticking to the comb as you pull it away. And you can just make really beautiful patterns out of it. It's just, like, really gorgeous, in my opinion. And the material is so special. And it being used for the device that it's being used for, it's just, like, I don't know. I don't know how to talk about it. It's just, like, I love it so much. So that's kind of where it started. Literally opening an old beaten down armoire in my bedroom where all my glasses are, and changing them and looking at all them and saying, like, oh, is this something, you know? Or is it one of those things where it's like, maybe you like to see the movies, but you wouldn't want to work in the movies? I was like, you know, I really like to buy glasses, but that's probably a very different experience than, you know, working in glasses, working in eyewear. But I just, you know, because of the freedom I had, you know, if I was working in finance, I wouldn't come home at night and do these kind of research. Like, it's just, I feel like my personality would say, like, yeah, I should do that, you know, so on and so forth, but I wouldn't actually go ahead and execute on it. And this freedom allowed me to go down that path. I always say, like, the company came about going down, like, a rabbit hole. Like, it was just, like, one step after another. And then before I knew it, I was at the bottom, not on purpose, just.
And so you ended up, so you were working with acetate, and then, like, how did you morph that passion or interest into something that could be a business model?
Yeah, so I, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the first thing I did was just try to understand the industry. Like, just try to understand, like, I knew about Luxottica passively. I don't think I appreciated how pervasive they were. But understanding where they lied, like, how much of the market do they have? So, like, if they own Lens Crafters and Sunglass Hut, and I think they also own Pearl Vision, one of the other major chains, it's like, well, if I had a glass company, I'd never be able to sell in those stores. So how much of the market are those stores? Let's take those out. So, like, is there still a market that is relevant for me to address? And I'm really, if I'm being realistic, I'm probably going to address the U.S. market. I don't have the mental capacity as a one person to deal with, like, international especially like you said, because it's a medical device. In Europe, actually, there are stricter regulations on how the glasses have to be made. So I kind of felt like, oh, you know what? Why aren't there any American manufacturers? It doesn't make sense. I know there used to be. I know that there were, like Ray-Ban used to produce in Long Island. They used to produce in Texas. Actually upstate New York in Rochester was like a, I don't know if it was an epicenter, but it was a big center of kind of smaller eyewear production that was happening in the U.S. in the 70s and 80s and so forth. And I learned that, you know, how they slowly all went out of business through a variety of factors. One of them not being able to keep up with the cost of outsourcing that a lot of brands were doing. And it was in an era where the consumer, the U.S. consumer at least, really cared about price. Just across the board, you know, they weren't looking at, you know, is this toxic? Who's making this? Where is it being made? Is it being made by like fair labor? So it was just like, you know, an era of discount stores and what's the price, and that's good for me. And so in that context, like story and somewhat quality has a lot less sway in a purchasing decision. But I thought, okay, so I kind of understand why it's gotten pushed out of the eyewear world. But, you know, now in 2014, I want to say it was that I was thinking about this, 2014, it's like, oh, wow, there's a big interest in where things are made and how they're made and who's making them and what's kind of the output of their product beyond the product itself. The example I always use is Whole Foods. Whole Foods is a huge corporation, but they are predicated on where something is made and how it is made and the quality of the make, despite them being a big corporation.
Sure.
And you can look to microbreweries, how many more have popped up over, say, the last 10 years, even 5 years. You can look at a brand like Shinola, who, you know, a large part of their story is that they make watches in Detroit or in the United States. And, you know, the list can go on and on. I mean, I think it really started, honestly, with like farm to table food at restaurants. You know, I can remember like growing up and the slow introduction of farm to table. And it was kind of like at the beginning thought of as a little bit pretentious, like at some of these restaurants. And now it's like, if it's not farm to table, like, that's gross.
What are you doing?
Yeah, right. Where is that coming from? Right. Like, I wouldn't dare eat there. It's like not even it's almost not even a marketing thing. It's just a given. Like, it has to be fresh and locally sourced. So I thought, you know, maybe this is the time that, you know, the market might be interested in a locally made product. And understanding, like, you know, giving a little bit of clarity into the process and to what we do, as opposed to being this big dark machine. So that helped all these things kind of like help build my confidence slowly, like, oh, there's no one really doing Made in America products. There is this movement that I feel like is consistently growing of consumers caring more about where things are made and how they're made. And even of the brands who are kind of smaller that we would be in the same realm of niche brands, they're not really producing themselves. They're all going to a third party, and their value add, in my opinion, a lot of times is marketing. They're, sure, they're really good marketers. They're really good brand builders. And so I thought that, you know, if we could produce ourselves, this could be a differentiating factor. And it could be a differentiating factor for a few reasons. One is, you know, we'll be made in America, which will be pretty unique. We will know how to make a pair of glasses, which is, I don't know if I call it a trade secret, but it's not something you can go out and learn. There's no school, there's no book. As much as I watched videos, you know, I'm talking about clips, short clips. There's no one willing to teach you. I tried going to offer to work for free in Italian factories. They're not interested. I tried to find people who used to work in the American eyewear industry that might still be around and might be willing to consult. Couldn't find them. There's no equipment suppliers in the United States. There's no distributors of equipment from overseas in the United States because the industry doesn't exist. So why would there be a distributor? I thought, okay, we could have a unique situation where we're making in New York, and the fact that if we can figure out how to make it, there is some level of barrier to entry there. You know, like, it's not an easy process to figure out. It's, someone can't just say, oh, that's a really great idea, I'm going to do it tomorrow. I'm going to set up a restaurant right next door to you and offer very similar food at a discounted price. That, of course, somebody could do it. It's not impossible to do, but it physically takes time. There's only so many suppliers of certain things in the world, and everyone has to buy it from them, and so it takes a long time for them to make them. And, you know, these things, a lot of them are made in Europe, and they're closed in July, and they're closed at the end of December, and they're closed at the beginning of January, and so there's just a lot of long lead times for these situations. So I was like, okay, at least I could have some comfort that if we spend this time and this money and this effort, and we put together this idea, and it's successful, and people like it, and people are interested in it, that, you know, we can kind of have a business for a period of time before someone came in and totally likes try to do the undercut version of what we were doing. And then the last point is, you know, I thought that there was like a physical competitive advantage. Like, we can make 10 frames. Like, if you don't have your own factory, you can't make 10 frames. You know, you have to place a minimum order. So if we have a great relationship with a partner, we can do a custom, you know, partnership where we make a shape and a color that's unique to them. And, you know, maybe they're not a big store, so they don't want to buy 50 frames of the same color. But 10 would be interesting and unique for them to offer to their clients. And so we could offer that. I also wanted to be close to customers that I could physically get to them, like jump on a plane and be there. If there's a real problem, I want to be able to bring the inventory replacement that might be at issue and physically go there and take care of it myself.
Sure.
That's important to me. So you kind of, it kind of like just started to slowly build up of all these factors that suggested, you know, if done right. And look, there's always, you never know until you try. You never know until you jump off the cliff. It could be researched to infinitum. Like, maybe people just don't like the product, or maybe you'll just never be able to make the quality that you say. But as much as I could do before actually saying go, I felt everything was supportive of the effort.
So how did you end up in Brooklyn?
Oh, we were looking for a space for over a year. I mean, pretty much goes without saying there's no space in Manhattan. I mean, there's space that's zoned for industrial in Manhattan, but you can't afford it.
Sure.
And you're going to be outbid by a clothing company for that space that you technically could produce in. So we had the space we ended up in was the first space we ever saw, except we didn't move in until a year later. The reason is we saw the space, it was the right setup, and there was a current tenant in there that had a 5-year lease, and they kept telling the Brooklyn Army Terminal, which is the building we're in, which is owned by the city, I'm gonna leave next month. I'm gonna go start a different business, so I'm gonna be out next month. Well, he did that for 12 months. So while he was constantly delaying, we would go around, obviously, and look for space, because at this point, Brian had joined, which we'll touch on later, but Brian had joined me, and we were doing all our preparation of equipment and processes as well as we could. But like, at some point we just kind of we need the space to actually try this stuff now. There's only so much theoretical work you can do. And the problem is, if you want running water, heavy power, if you need concrete floors, assuming you're not on the ground floor, you need concrete floors, because we have equipment that's, one piece of our equipment, 7,000 pounds. So it has to be on concrete. Maybe you find the concrete floors on the third floor, but the freight elevator isn't big enough. Or maybe the freight elevator is big enough, but it can't carry that load. So to find all of these kind of needs in what we were looking for of a 3,000 square foot space, we didn't realize was so unheard of in New York. If you wanted 15,000 square feet, and you wanted all those, you're fine, you're set. There's lots of large lots that have all those amenities in one place. But for a 2,000, our space is 2,000 square feet. You know, it's 1,000 less than we had aimed for. Literally in over a year of looking, is the only space that fit the criteria. So
did you have any preconceptions about Brooklyn being a downtown Manhattan native as a business location?
As a business location, I had a preconception that for this kind of business, that Brooklyn was the place to go, like for a kind of manufacturing industrial type of business, that this was the, like, I'd never thought of Staten Island that way. I never thought of Queens that way. I never thought of the Bronx that way. But Brooklyn, for, I don't know, I, not based on much. So I'm sorry if I'm offending someone from the other boroughs, but it just, my sense was always like, there's a lot of kind of, you know, growing up and driving through Brooklyn, there's a lot of like auto repair shops and like small machinery companies. And granted, a lot of them are gone now, but that was just always my memory of it.
Got it. So now that you're there, what's next for you guys?
Well, so, you know, we just launched in January, so we're pretty new. We launched a second collection a couple of weeks ago, a smaller capsule collection of frames. And you know, our next, we have a long list of modifications that we have planned for the frames. So for example, we're going to be introducing matte frames, which we know how to do and we can do. We just literally don't have the time at this moment to build out that capability. We want to, you know, work on partnerships with other brands, like do some partnerships where, you know, maybe they're going to bring in their conception of what a good piece of acetate looks like. You know, we have a big library to choose from, you know, and I would say we have a pretty consistent aesthetic of clean, understated, fairly muted tones, nothing super bright, but I don't think that's necessarily what we should have forever. And so it would be great to tap into kind of the visual knowledge base of a partner who thinks about it much differently than us. That's really exciting for us. We've had a lot of interest in brands having us produce for them, so private label for them, which is something, you know, we want to explore. We don't have the human capacity to explore that at this moment, but it is a part of the business that we think could be interesting. We wouldn't want to be a kind of mass market private label supplier, but you know, 1, 2, 3 companies that, you know, you kind of align with on your approaches, we think that could be interesting to like, I don't know, energize and bring new thoughts into the company.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to From Day One, how Brooklyn entrepreneurs got their start. This series is made possible by a grant from the Made in New York Media Center in conjunction with The Bridge, a news site dedicated to reporting on business in Brooklyn. For more from The Bridge, learn more about today's guest, or to listen to more episodes of From Day One, visit us at thebridgebk.com. That's thebridgebk.com. From Day One is produced by Kim Thornton, Steve Kep, and myself, Nick Bailey. Audio editing and post-production by Al Sigman. The From Day One logo was created by Joe Meyer, and our theme music was performed by Jody Rockwell and the Ambulance. Thanks for listening.